actually saw something on Instagram recently. This influencer was talking about a study, and our colleague said, the study she showed was not related to this topic. And you want to look at the actual study. So are they sharing it? Are they sharing the citation? Are they sharing a link to it? Are they giving you the title so that you can look it up? And to your point, even if it is an actual study, even headlines about studies like are oftentimes just very sensational.
Let's face it, trying to eat well these days can feel really confusing. From conflicting advice to endless scrolls of health hack videos, figuring out what's true and what's hype is harder than ever. In this episode of the Good Clean Nutrition Podcast, Melissa Joy Dobbins is back to help us navigate it all. We're talking social media red flags, ethical product promotion, GLP-1 medications, and how to sharpen your digital health literacy. Whether you're a healthcare provider or simply someone trying to make better choices, this episode is packed with practical tips and honest conversation. Let's dive in. It's really easy to find information online that reinforces what we already believe. So if you're looking for something, there's this confirmation bias that plays a huge role in shaping perspectives. If you're looking for something, you can probably find it and be like, see, I told you, or this is what I was saying all along. So how can people ensure that they're consulting a variety of sources and avoiding getting in this echo chamber where you're just hearing what you want to hear?
Well, I think first of all is being aware of confirmation bias and knowing that we all have it. It's human nature. We all tend to do that. And so if you know that, you can catch yourself and say, okay, I'm falling into that habit, that natural instinct to do that. So being aware of that and then seeking different sources, it used to be easier. We've kind of gone from broadcasting to narrowcasting with the changes in the journalism landscape and social media. So the algorithms, if we like certain things, we just get fed more of what we like. So we really have to be proactive to get out of that bubble. It's really, really become a serious issue. But there are some things that you can do with just trying to be a better critical thinker, besides being aware of confirmation bias. I've done several podcast episodes on this because I find it so interesting. The way that the brain works, we make these mental shortcuts because we have to, because in order to get through our day, we can't belabor and think slowly about every single thing. But learning more about that process about, okay, when do I need to stop and think more slowly and more critically? There's a lot of different types of cognitive biases, and confirmation bias is just one of them. So I would encourage people to kind of look into that because it's really interesting the more you learn about how the brain is working.
Right. One thing that I do is I'll be like, okay, I'm seeing a lot on this. Like, what's the other side? What can I find? Or what are people saying that's different than this messaging? So I do like to poke around and be like, am I getting the full story?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's easier for us, I think, healthcare professionals that have a lot of training in understanding and reading research. But if you don't have a background in nutrition or health or research, and you come across a health claim online, what steps should they take to fact check it and start to understand what it means for them?
Yes. So that's something that we all face. So yeah, looking at different sources of information, looking at how credentialed or credible those sources are, and then checking for those red flags. This is from the MyFitnessPal survey where they did the survey on TikTok about how accurate social media posts were. I think it was like 2% accuracy. It was that low. But things like verifying credentials, cross-checking content, like we've been talking about, trusting that expert majority, questioning quick results, that's a huge one. And then outsmarting the algorithm, we talked a little bit about that. Like, again, if you like certain things, the algorithm's going to keep giving those things to you and you're in your bubble. So get out of that bubble and look at different outlets. And then, of course, always seek professional advice. And not everybody can go to their doctor or dietitian every time they have a question. And honestly, I would like to say, you know, that Let's say you have questions about supplements. Not every doctor or dietitian will have those answers. So that's another layer of challenge, is finding the right healthcare professional for you and your specific needs and situation.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, I think sometimes people get frustrated if their particular person that they work with doesn't know everything, but it's important because we all have different specialties or background or education. So I'm constantly encouraging my clients to like be working with healthcare professionals that match their values and will meet them at the level that they want to engage with research and questions, things like that.
Yeah. And if the healthcare professional says, you know what? I don't know the answer to that. Let's look into that together.
Welcome to Ginger's Plate. Normally, I use this segment to share a favorite recipe, but today I wanted to do something a little different. It's a tip I use when my clients bring me something they've heard of, read, or seen online that they want to know if it's real and could help them. My client might want to optimize their nutrition, so from there, we'll actually pull up the product together. I often say, what's in it? So we read the nutrition label, we look at the health claims, and we check out the ingredients. Then we talk about quality and manufacturing, and together we compare all of that to their health goals. You can also be a sleuth like this on your own. If you're being marketed a product or an idea, put your critical thinking lens on and do a deeper dive beyond the headline. What is it, and will it get you where you want to go? The reality is that we do have a lot of online personalities or influencers, non-medical professionals, promoting health products like supplements or powders. Do you have any advice on how people promoting products can be using ethical sponsorship disclosures? Like, if you're doing that kind of work, how do you protect your audience and yourself?
What's interesting is there were some kind of recent changes in the FTC guidelines that kind of caught some of us by surprise, because the guidelines hadn't changed in over 10 years. And it was not like they put out an APB about this. So it's really important to stay up on those changes. And some of the nuances that I would love to share is the disclosure needs to be even more, they call it clear and conspicuous. So because we're using more videos and images in our posts, the disclosure needs to be on the image or the video as well, not just like at the top of the copy, and certainly not buried at the bottom of the copy, that it's sponsored content. That we really need our audiences and the consumers to know that it's sponsored content. So they know, well, there might be a bias there, maybe there's not. It's for them to decide. And the other thing is to disclose who the company is. That was something that we never really thought of before or had to do before. Just, oh, it's sponsored. But yeah, so you just want to make it really clear and obvious if something's sponsored, and let the consumers and your audience just make their own decisions on that. I think also as dietitians and any healthcare professional, I feel very strongly that I only work with companies and products and services and any sponsor that aligns with my values. I'm not just going to take a paycheck from just anybody. And those choices will differ from provider to provider or professional to professional. There are some of my colleagues work with companies and products that I wouldn't. I'm nothing against them, but doesn't align with my values. Also, like, what are you kind of willing to stick your neck out for? I feel really strongly about this. Like, as a diabetes educator, I will stick my neck out about sugar and sweeteners and safe intake of both of those and how neither one of those is a villain, because I feel really strongly about it. Other people, they might not want to put the sugar or sweetener target on their back. I understand. You do have to pick and choose, like I say, what you're willing to go to the mat on. And there are things that I'm not willing to go to the mat on and things that I am.
Yeah, it's such an interesting point. And representing or working with brands that you really align with and products that you're like, yes, like I recommend this to my clients all the time and I use it myself and I think it could be helpful to you. That's not a bad thing in my mind. But the problem is if we're not being honest about it, right? And so that disclosure piece is really, really important. There are people that I think are not disclosing, or there's some products that are not what I would recommend that are floating around out there. I mean, I mentioned some of the supplements. I'll look at them and I'm such a stickler for, do I know that it's safe for you? Especially for my people in cancer treatment, like I cannot mess around with something that I might not know is completely safe. So I really, when people bring me products or when they see something that somebody has been touting, I really like to do a deep dive on it myself for sure. And sometimes in partnership with my client, I'm like, let's look at the label. Who made this? Why is there no label? I think the benefit that you get from having qualified healthcare professionals talk about products is hopefully we're doing that already on the front end, or else we wouldn't be promoting it.
Yes. Yeah. It's so important. And I just want to add on to that because I did a podcast interview on a certain product and the science really seemed to be there. One of our colleagues was the guest and I was talking with another researcher and asking them about what they thought about this particular product. And this researcher is very, very highly respected. And he said, the science is really shady. And I mean, this is an extreme example, but my point being, I totally respected his opinion and I took that episode down.
Looking for a protein shake that's clean, simple, and seriously satisfying? Orgain's 20 grams clean protein shake delivers exactly that. 20 grams of grass-fed milk protein with no soy, gluten, or artificial sweeteners. It's got 130 calories per serving. It's smooth, delicious, and ready whenever you are, whether you're headed to the gym, the office, or just need a quick nourishing snack. With flavors like creamy chocolate fudge, staying on track has never tasted better. Check it out at orgain.com. We've talked a lot about misinformation online and some of the negativity that's out there, but there is a lot of really helpful information. What is the easiest way that a listener can find reliable and reputable information online?
Well, I mean, there's, of course, the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. There's even a Find a Dietitian link on their site, but also like you can just Google finding a local dietitian as well. And then, you know, just things like the American Medical Association or the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Diabetes Association, the Association of Diabetes Care and Education Specialists. So start with those governing bodies that are professional associations and see what their recommendations are.
Yeah, American Heart Association I use so often. There's some really, really great ones out there. And as far as the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics goes, like I've written a lot of content for them. So it's coming from real qualified professionals out there, certainly. When I'm on Instagram, I will often use keywords like I'll look up gut health dietitian, like autoimmune doctor, nurses. Like I'm looking and actually searching for these healthcare words. I know that one thing you and I wanted to talk about and we're chatting about the other day is the risk of when somebody says, oh, this study showed. Personally, I want to see the study. I want to go to it. Is it from the 1990s? Was it sponsored by a brand? Are you interpreting it correctly?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually saw something on Instagram recently. I think it was one of our colleagues doing like one of those stitches where this influencer was talking about a study and our colleague said, the study she showed was not related to this topic, and you want to look at the actual study. So are they sharing it? Are they sharing the citation? Are they sharing a link to it? Are they giving you the title so that you can look it up? And to your point, even if it is an actual study, even like headlines about studies, like forget influencers, even just headlines about studies are oftentimes just very sensational. And I always say the headlines are usually not the bottom line takeaways that people need. And we can't be on top of all of it. But if there's a specific area like yours is oncology, mine is diabetes, that we do want to kind of take a deeper dive. I also have a free sound science toolkit on my site that I created for our peers, but anybody can access it. And I think the content in there is applicable to the general public that just helps you think more critically. Understand like the research. It's not a specific food or topic. It's all just about critical thinking, just the nature of nutrition research. What's the difference between a randomized control trial or an observational epidemiology? Just a collection. It's just a curation. It's like books and videos and online articles that people can access just by going to my website.
I love that. There's a lot of good resources out there. I think it's a best practice when I'm sharing research to also mention the limitations or where more research is needed in that area. But to your point, it's really hard to have enough time for that if you're doing a really short soundbite. So I think that's a big limitation that people might be experiencing.
Exactly. Yeah. I think if you're in this space and you want to do a better job, then I would say you could kind of have a sentence formula be something like, here's what the research shows. It's strong, moderate, weak, and here's what we don't know and what we might want to look into next.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of research is like, finds really cool stuff and then also uncovers so many more. Like, and we need to understand this in different races, ethnicities, age groups.
It was not applicable to different populations. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you know that it was done on all men? And so we don't know what this means for women. Like, that's really important to understand when you're interpreting the research.
Yes.
And then you also mentioned GLP-1 meds, which sometimes we call weight loss injectables, or this classification of medications that a lot of people are using. It helps with weight. It also helps with diabetes and blood sugars. How have you seen misinformation around that? Or how is that influencing the way we talk about diabetes? Mm-hmm.
Well, very interesting. Everybody's talking about these new weight loss meds. We've been using them for 2 decades in diabetes. There are some differences, and the newer medications are basically stronger than the ones that we were using in the past few decades, but 2 decades. But I think the positive thing is that it's helping us talk more about obesity as a disease. And hopefully decreasing some of the stigma and shame around obesity and type 2 diabetes, because oftentimes obesity is the trigger for type 2 diabetes. Mm. And also talking about the food noise. I think this is really interesting that knowing that a medication is helping people reduce their food noise. I mean, before these medications, I don't remember hearing that phrase.
Yeah,
and
me too.
So it's exciting because, all right, so somebody's food noise is decreased, their hunger is under control, and us as dietitians working with them, instead of focusing our efforts on trying to get them to cut back on their portions and to manage their eating triggers, now we can focus on, okay, here's what you can eat to boost your nutrition if you're not that hungry. And here's how you have to actually make sure you're getting adequate nutrition, because a lot of people are not hungry at all. And I'm concerned about malnutrition for a lot of these people. So I think it's very promising. And I think it is decreasing some of the stigma and the shame, which is so important.
You mentioned the word food noise. I'm hearing that a lot too. Can you define it, or how do people use that term?
Yeah, it's like the cravings that they're feeling all the time. And before we had this type of medication that addressed that, I mean, we've had all kinds of weight loss medications over the decades, but this in particular seems to be addressing, because it deals with the hormones, right?
Right.
And it's like, okay, it puts more of a physical connotation to it instead of a mental or emotional. And so I think it helps validate that some people just are really struggling with being hungry all the time and craving certain foods. And it's not just that they need to see a therapist.
Yeah, it's really powerful. And a lot of patients that I work with are on them too. Even some of my patients that are being treated long-term for cancer. I think there's some stigma with using those medications that also needs to be addressed. I mean, there's a lot of chatter about it online. I mean, I'm just hearing a lot of like, take this medication and you lose lots of weight and everything's fine. But while there's so many amazing good things about it and incredible research, like there's also some stuff that I'm worried about, maybe potential for reducing bone mass or losing muscle mass with your weight loss. Like those things need to be addressed. Or when people say, yeah, I just don't eat anything, I'm like, Like you said, that can cause malnutrition, or I'm forever trying to get people to be more physically active or really focus on their strength building. Cause I'm like, you need to get enough protein. You need to do strength building exercise to protect these systems that we need to have in place long term. So Melissa, you have such a history of working in diabetes. What are some of the most common myths you're hearing about diabetes and nutrition?
Oh gosh. Well, for sure, the number one is that sugar causes diabetes.
Yeah.
And that's actually an example of maybe there's a granule of truth to it in the fact that if you eat a lot of sugar and you gain weight and you have a predisposition for diabetes, that could trigger diabetes. But just eating sugar does not cause it. And there are some people who could have a very high sugar diet, can be overweight, and they will never get diabetes. So no, sugar does not cause diabetes. The other one is like white foods are bad. I can't eat any white foods, potatoes, bread, rice. Those are carbohydrates. So those are foods that would need to be monitored. And depending on the person's, if they're pre-diabetes, diabetes, if they're on medications, if they're monitoring their blood sugars, that depending on all of those factors. And then we talked about this briefly, is like the low and no calorie sweeteners. People are afraid that they're not safe or that they're bad. And I want people with diabetes to have any tool available to them to help them enjoy their foods, but keep their blood sugar stable. And if they want to use low and no calorie sweeteners to do that, I want them to know that they're safe.
Those are really, really good ones. And I have a couple others I want to run by you because I talk about them so often. I mean, white rice is a very interesting example. And I know that some people, their blood sugar spikes hugely with it, but not everybody. And what I say to my clients is like cultures around the world for a very long time consume white rice every day, multiple times a day. And it's so villainized. And I think there's a huge part of like missed cultural competency going on there.
Agree 100%. And that's how we want to convey to the patient is if this is an important food to you culturally or celebration wise, or just you were raised on this, let's figure out how we can include it in your diet.
It's a miss to just be like, don't eat it ever. I don't care what it means to you. Will you please walk me through bananas and diabetes and blood sugar management? I talk about this all the time.
Well, a banana can be a lot of different sizes. It can be a lot of different levels of ripeness. I think that as long as you're counting the carbohydrates, if that's something that you need to do, again, somebody might be like pre-diabetes or type 2 diabetes, and they're not necessarily counting every gram, but they're saying, well, I'm going to have one serving of fruit at each meal, then as long as you're, I mean, gosh, how can you really overdose and overeat a banana on bananas? I mean, we do recommend that people not have just fruit alone. We do recommend that you have like mixed meals and snacks. But that's any carbohydrate, and fruit has fiber and it has phytonutrients.
I also hear like starchy veggies like carrots.
Oh,
starchy veggies.
See, I was going to bring up carrots, but those aren't starchy.
Right.
But the carrots get it. So this makes me think of all the people out there who are, I'm not going to hate on this, but I'm just saying, using the CGMs and they don't have diabetes or prediabetes, we can really cross that line and get hyper-focused on every little thing that we're biohacking if we're not careful. And so I think we really need to be careful about being too freaked out about certain things. So if you don't have diabetes or prediabetes or reactive hypoglycemia, the foods and beverages you eat and drink are going to fluctuate your blood sugars. But if you don't have a metabolic issue with your blood sugars, those fluctuations will be within a normal range. But I just hate to see people get freaked out about those normal fluctuations.
You're right, like focusing on everything you put in your mouth and like looking at how it translates, like that can be really stressful. I think it's important for people to be looking out for, like don't just look at what worked for you is going to work for me, but also as a healthcare provider, we need to be really careful. What works for me isn't going to work for you. And we should probably not be sharing information in that way because everyone's so different.
Yeah. And at the same time, if somebody knows themselves and they know their mindset and they would, like what you did, oh, I'm going to learn. This is kind of interesting. I just want to check this out. That's a healthy approach. Nothing wrong with that. Just know yourself and know, like, it could be a slippery slope for some people. Yeah. So,
well, we've talked about a lot of different things today, Melissa. I'm so glad that I had you on. What are takeaways you want listeners to really understand?
I think the critical thinking piece is just huge. Like, just try to improve your own critical thinking skills and help your patients and clients and the public also improve their critical thinking skills. And sometimes it's just simple concepts like telling them, just remember, one study doesn't change everything. There are some things that can just help put them in a mindset of like, oh, okay, or that headline doesn't necessarily mean the bottom line, or this study was on animals and that's not translated to humans, but it can inform some of the future research that needs to be done. Just little tiny things to help people go, oh, okay, I'll take a step back and I won't feel like I'm having whiplash. Knowing that nutrition science just continues to evolve, communicating those uncertainties and everybody becoming more comfortable with that being a normal aspect of nutrition science.
Yeah, it has changed a lot and it's going to continue to change. So as healthcare professionals, we have to really stay on top of it, whether you're doing more school or just doing your continuing education, which is required, doing trainings from people like you, listening to evidence-based podcasts, following evidence-based people online. There are really great resources. You just have to use critical thinking to find them.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was so fun talking to you. And I just really appreciate like our long-term, I don't know, partnership and all the mentorship you provided and all the things I've learned from you. It's really fun to do work like this together.
Oh, thank you, Ginger. It's always a pleasure talking with you. And I'm so glad that we were able to do this.
From understanding confirmation bias to navigating GLP-1 medication misinformation, this conversation with Melissa covered so much. Remember, nutrition science is always evolving. That doesn't mean we can't trust it. It means we need to stay curious, ask questions, and lean on credentialed experts for guidance. A huge thanks to Melissa for her wisdom, transparency, and passion for helping people get to the facts. If you're looking for more from her, check out her Soundbites podcast or head to soundbitesrd.com. Don't forget to rate and follow the Good Clean Nutrition podcast on your favorite platform. And as always, thanks so much for listening.